Welcome to another Leon Chiney Report. And do we have a report tonight? Eclectic. We're going to talk about Wall Street, about how the Democrats are doing with Susan DiPersio. Then we'll bring Mike Burstyn on, who's starring on a new big hit play called Lansky. And then Rabbi Blech, we know him because he's been to the Vatican. We find out why the Pope is allowing a man who says the Holocaust never took place to become frocked again. He was defrocked, I think. Now he's frocked. We'll see what that, if you know what that means, you're ahead of the game. Anyway, Dave Kansas, who used to be an editor at Wall Street Journal, you remember that place where Rudolph Burnick took over, wrote a book this week that came out called The End of Wall Street as We Know It. By the way, you know how Wall Street got its name?
Because of a wall that the Dutch built, I believe, in the 1600s at the north end of the settlement.
No one would know the truth anyway, but it sounds good. I have no idea. I think it had to do with the Revolutionary War, didn't it? I'm not sure. Maybe the rabbi knows. He blesses everything. Okay, so what happened? You tell us.
Well, the problems began a while ago when Wall Street started to grow more and more confident with their risk management skills. They believed increasingly they could take greater and greater risks without having any problems. So when the real estate boom took place, they tied all kinds of complicated investment instruments to the real estate boom. And when real estate started to go bad, the Wall Street investments tied to that, usually paid for with a lot of borrowed money, went bad very quickly. And that's really at the core of the problem right now, all these toxic assets tied to a declining asset,
all right,
real estate.
That's obvious. So what happened is they packaged them into mortgages called collateralized mortgage obligations. They sent them all over the world. And bondholders are dying because they're not going to get paid on their mortgages, and everybody's in a state of collapse, and we're in a recession, depression, inflation, reflation, whatever you want to call it. People are hungry, they're upset, they're not making a living. The only thing that will cheer them up is Broadway, so you go see shows like Lansky or In the Heights or Billy Elliot. Now, the real question is, who's at blame?
Well, I think that it's difficult to pin the blame on any one group. There are a lot of people who bear responsibility. I think, you know, the government was probably too aggressive in trying to get people to own homes when they should not have. But it's really Wall Street that acted as the amplifier here, where they...
It's greed.
Greed is part of capitalism. It's when greed becomes overconfident and becomes corrupt,
right,
when it becomes a problem. So I think just to blame greed is kind of
it's basic, I think. It's generic. But you want to be specific?
Well, I think greed is a building block, but it's really overconfidence. It's a belief that you can't do any wrong, so you just keep tripling and quadrupling down on what ultimately is a bad investment or a bad idea.
It's called stupidity.
It can be called stupidity. I mean, over time.
No,
I mean,
people are suffering, and we can't play around with this. But I think, and I know a little bit about this game, that Paulson made two terrible errors. Number one, he zigzagged in his policy, which collapsed the confidence. If you don't have confidence in a financial system, it does not work. So he collapsed that confidence because people need stability when they buy a bond. They want to know if they buy a bond, it's going to be at a certain level. You know, you can trade it between highs and lows. But for total collapse, no. And they held, the world felt no confidence in that. Mm-hmm. And number two, the collapse of Lehman was one of the great financial errors in the world, and it'll go down in history as one of the great errors.
Yeah, well, two things. You know, with Paulson, the zigzagging on the plan, the TARP plan.
Terrible.
I mean, we're kind of going back to the original idea now, where they're talking about building a bad bank to take the toxic assets, which is something Geithner has talked about. And the issue of the confidence is absolutely huge. That's the big problem right now. There is no confidence in the system. I mean, banks don't trust to lend to each other, to businesses, to individuals. People with good credit and a job have trouble getting a mortgage.
You can't get credit.
It's very difficult right now.
You can't even get commercial credit.
Yeah, it's very hard.
And you'll see maybe really dangerous signs in commercial real estate because people who bought buildings about 4 or 5 years ago, their rollover now for mortgages is coming due. And no one is giving money. I had three bankers in my office today, and they're upset, but their rules are they can't give money.
Because they don't know if they're going to get paid back.
On top of that, everybody's hoarding cash.
Yes.
Nobody's spending.
Absolutely. Down to the individual level. You know, you just walk outside the door here, people You ask anybody, they're going to be, I'm eating at home, I'm walking to work, I'm not taking a cab. They're saving money. They're trying to save every nickel they can.
That's why you didn't bring a tie tonight.
Well,
it's expensive.
I sold it outside.
That's right.
Exactly. You need to save every penny you can. And what that does
you came with a few apples in your pockets, too, right?
Well, and a soup ladle. But the consumer spending is 70% of the economy.
Right.
So if you have the whole country scared, which they are, lacking confidence, saving every penny, it's going to really hit retail hard. And we're already seeing that. Circuit City filed for bankruptcy. Starbucks is closing hundreds of stores. I mean, there's a real impact in this lack of confidence down to the street level.
It's horrible. So you have a remedy in here. People are going to buy this book now because he knows how to solve it. In case you forgot, it's A Guide to the End of Wall Street as We Know It, What You Need to Know About the Greatest Financial Crisis of Our Time and How to Survive It. Let's forget all the other stuff and talk about how to survive.
Well, I think one of the most important things that people have to do is get their own financial house in order. A lot of people have carried way too much expensive debt for too long, credit card debt especially. And one simple strategy is, gasoline prices for most people who drive, $4 a gallon or more a year ago. And now it's a lot lower.
Down
a lot. So why don't you just pretend it's $4 and take that differential to pay off your credit card debt or other debt that you've accrued when you live beyond your means. And I think that's the first order of business. And then people need to build up their savings after they paid off their debt. And then they need to think about the stock market differently. People thought of the stock market as a fairly low-risk vehicle, but it's a high-risk vehicle. And as you get older, you should have less money in the stock market. You got to preserve the capital that you've earned. And too many people, as they got closer to retirement age, were too fully exposed to the stock market. So I think it's being more conservative and being more fundamental.
Take a young person who wants to really save for the future, get their kids educated and all that. Usually they went into mutual funds if they didn't know a lot about it. If you're a doctor or dentist, you got screwed by some broker who tried to tell you that this is good and you get a tax deferral, they all got killed. So be wary of a doctor who's on the phone with his broker all the time trying to treat you because you're in trouble. But they don't know where to go, so you go to an investment advisor. Mm-hmm. So the investment advisor says, I know a guy who can get you 10% on your money for the next 10 years. His name is Bernie Madoff. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I can get you in. But if I can get you in, you're set for life.
Mm-hmm.
You're great. And every institution is with us. Rabbi Blech, who teaches at Yeshiva University, is going to take a pay cut maybe because Madoff had $110 million in his fund over there. Mm. So you had an investment advisor. You paid him because he's supposed to be skilled and he's supposed to know everything. And people talk today. I talk to doctors, friends of mine. How much are you down? You're happy if you're only down consistent with everybody about 25 or 30% on your IRA or your other thing. Everybody is happy. I only lost 30%, If a guy lost only 20%, he buys 10 tickets to Lansky tomorrow. He's celebrating, And it's a serious problem, though, for people who are young families and to get confidence in the investment system now. How do you do that?
Well, I think the danger is that we extrapolate the present time out to eternity. The fact is that the economy goes down and it does come back. We're already more than a year into the recession. Recessions since World War II have averaged about 2 years.
I think we're further, though, Dave. I've seen people really... I've been through a couple of recessions, and I had Paul Maiden on from Forbes magazine who went through about six cycles. And they're pretty good at tracking this stuff. He said, this is really bad because this is universal. You go to England, you go to France, you go to Hong Kong. Hong Kong collapsed totally.
China slowed down.
They have no GDP.
Down.
So it's a world collapse. Mm-hmm. So now what do you do?
Well, the governments are trying to do all they can to restore confidence. And I think, to posit that the economy and thereby extension, businesses and the economy, the businesses won't come back and therefore the market won't come back is, I think, a very grim reading based on the current climate and extrapolating it outward. Remember back in 80 and 81 when we had interest rates toward 20%, brutal, brutal recession, terrible layoffs, and in the center of that storm, people said, this is the worst thing since the Great Depression. It's not going to get better anytime soon. And within a couple of years, things had started to get better. So I think that there is a temptation.
Yeah, but you got
to play. To think this is the worst thing ever, and will never change.
What you're saying is logical, but it's emotional now. If
it
you're out
emotional,
of a job,
yeah.
You're telling me play a record about 1981, how you recovered. So he's going to buy a record and play a record. It's not going to change his life. We're in a desperate state now where people are, you read the stories all day, mm-hmm. I saw a story in the New York Post somewhere, a guy killed his whole family because he was, he lost his job. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's tragic, and other people have, people related to bad investment schemes have taken their own lives. I mean, it is an emotional thing, and I think when people are caught up in the emotion, you need to encourage them to try to take a step back.
No, I agree with you. Does your book do that?
Yes.
Does your book do that?
It takes a step back and tries to say, hey, look, this is the current situation you're in. Let's take care of ourselves first. Let's get our house in order and give strategies to do that. And as things get better, you'll be in a position to have more confidence. One of the reasons it's so emotional is that too many people were living beyond their means, from people of middling income and from very high incomes.
True.
A lot of the people who unfortunately got caught up in, say, the Madoff scandal, we're all in Madoff. They didn't have a diversification of any kind,
yeah,
and it's very difficult. I have friends who lost college kids' savings through Madoff, and these are very hard and emotional things, and it takes time to absorb that, deal with that, and then start to put it back together. But I think that that's the right way forward.
No, what you say is logical. You got to look at what you have and what you're spending and try to save. But if you have nothing, then you're in French off Soros. You know what that means? You got problems. It's a terrible situation.
Yeah.
I'd like to give people hope, and maybe Obama can do something to bring the feeling of the nation up, so they will have confidence. I think that's his sincere mission right now is for him to do that. So,
and he's trying to. If you look at, he's really reaching across. He's trying to engage the Republicans.
We're going to bring Susan DiPersio on in about 2 minutes. She's going to tell us how the Republicans are loving Obama or not. But every Republican I heard yesterday voted against the stimulus bill.
I think you're going to see a slightly different attitude in the Senate. I think there are already a lot of Republican-oriented tax cuts and incentives. I think there is a true effort to try to craft a program that will appeal to a broader swath of people, and I think that's actually going to be a better program than just a one way or the other. And I think that will help restore some confidence and give people some hope.
All right, Dave, where are you from? Not Kansas.
St. Paul, Minnesota.
Oh, okay. Minneapolis.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for coming on. We're coming back with Susan DiPersio, then Mike Burstyn, who's on Broadway with Lansky. It's called Off-Broadway, but he's really on Broadway. And then Rabbi Blech will tell us about how the Pope is behaving lately, because he's an expert on Vatican affairs. So we'll be right back.
What's wrong with this picture? Half of young Americans can't locate economic powers like Japan and India. 20% can't even find the Pacific Ocean. Without geography, our children aren't ready for the world. Geography is everywhere. It's incredible creatures. Rhythm. Fashion. Flavor. It's economics and politics. It's change. Understanding connections between people and places is critical in the 21st century. That's why we created mywonderfulworld.org. Go there now for your free parent and teacher action kits and give our kids the power of global knowledge. Because kids who understand our world today can succeed in it tomorrow.
Foreclosure doesn't affect just you. It affects your whole family, too. If you've fallen behind on your mortgage, we can help. Call 1-888-995-HOPE, because nothing is worse than doing nothing.
You've known for years that this is the number one cause of lung cancer, smoking. That's why the Surgeon General issued this warning. But do you know the number one cause of lung cancer for non-smokers? It's in this room. You can't see it or smell it. It's radon. Radon is an invisible radioactive gas that seeps inside your home from underground. It can build up to dangerous levels without notice. Now the Surgeon General has issued another lung cancer warning. And whether you smoke or not, breathing radon can cause lung cancer. That's why you need to have your home tested. Protect your family. Call 1-800-SOS-RADON. Heed the warning. Have your home tested, because radon problems can be fixed.
Way back, I'm talking to Susan DelPercio, who is the most talented lobbyist for the Republicans probably in the nation, probably the most beautiful also. Are you gloomy that you lost the election?
Well, I wish it turned out a different way, but now you have to look forward, and that's what Republicans really need to do now.
But they're disorganized now, aren't they?
To say the very least. That's being kind.
Who's running the party? Did they pick a national champion?
They will be shortly.
An African-American?
It looks like quite possibly, yeah. And it will be good, but I think the Republicans really still need to take a long, hard look at themselves, and just having a new chairman will not be enough.
McCain, is he going to be a maverick again, or that's his style?
I think there's no question about
it.
I think he gets to now he really gets to do whatever he wants, and that's his style.
Did he lose the election because of Sarah Palin?
No, I don't think so. I think he lost the election based on the economy. No question about it.
What's your honest opinion of Sarah Palin? Or maybe give me a dishonest opinion.
You know, she certainly tried to energize a base, but frankly, she had a problem being rolled out and she wasn't ready for prime time.
Did she save Katie Couric's job?
That could very well be.
I'm sure she did. I thought Couric was leaving after the elections. What's interesting now is New York State, because David Patterson has really made a lot of errors, especially with the Kennedy affair, the way he handled it. He's being wrapped in the papers on every side. Can Republicans really mount a good campaign against him, and who could that person be? Rudy Giuliani?
The best challenger against Patterson that the Republicans could put up would be Rudy Giuliani. And I would have said maybe 3-4 months ago it would be a very, very hard battle. Now I think it's definitely something that's very winnable for a Republican.
I don't want to ask you to be an expert on the other side. Will he be challenged by a Democrat?
I don't think so. Even no matter how weak he turns out, I just don't see them going, someone trying to do an end run and try and primary him that way. Because they'll still be the odd man out, if you will. And you can ask Swazi how well that worked for him.
Swazi. You know, I know Swazi about 15 years. I used to meet him at conventions all the time. And he's a very tenacious guy.
Absolutely. And very smart, and brought a lot of great ideas to the table, which ironically ended up being put in place in the Spitzer/Patterson administration.
For people who don't know him, he's not in the Babylon Talmud, and he's not in the Jerusalem Talmud, which I'm writing about. He's a Nassau executive, because his name is not household. And he's dying to become a governor, a senator, an alderman, a president of a shul, anything. He wants to be elected. He likes to be elected, no matter where he is. But are the Republicans... Look, you heard the financial crisis. You know mm-hmm. it. I know it. Everybody knows it. Do the Republicans have a different plan than Obama today? I mean, they voted against him in Congress,
right? Well,
that's
the problem with the Republican Party right now, is that they're not really putting up much alternative, frankly.
Right.
And... You know, some people say, hey, we could look at the vote that happened this week and that the Republicans were representing their constituency, which is true. I mean, a lot of people are just fundamentally get against it without necessarily understanding what happened because they don't like the word bailout. But at the other, on the other flip side, they could have said, hey, we understand that this country really wants to turn around. They elected Barack Obama by huge numbers. And maybe they should have gotten behind it to say, we're going to move beyond this partisan stuff and we're about you, all of you. Republican, Democrat, it doesn't matter, because this is the best idea out there, because they haven't been able to offer up another one. To say we want more tax breaks doesn't cut it.
So you sound like you're frustrated with the Republican Party.
Well, frustrated perhaps more because they're worried about an image versus going back to substance.
So the question is, it needs leadership now. Is there one formidable person, Boehner? Who's running, basically, even in Congress? Who's the minority leader?
Well, when you're in the position that the Republicans are now, they actually, you know, even though they have a minority leader, it's a really unique position for any Republican congressman or Republican senator, because they can really come out with their own ideas and kind of run, you know, their agenda. And that's a good thing. I mean, that's what the party needs to have, is a lot of ideas going out there.
Talk to me about Obama, and you think he'll be different than George Bush was in terms of Israel. A lot of people watch this show very interested in Israel. And we know that George Mitchell is over there now, and he's trying to do something. The question, which will not be resolved for another 20 years, whether Bush was really great for Israel because he gave him a pass, so to speak, or was not good because he never put anything together so that they would get a peace treaty. I'm not asking that, because if you ask most Israelis, Mike Burstyn is an Israeli, he might even agree that whatever Israel seemed to want, Bush seemed to give them on that level. You think things are going to change now with Obama?
Well, I think the Bush policies were based on an innate belief on that we needed to support Israel. I think Obama's decisions have been made that he has to show that he supports Israel, and he will do everything he can to show that the United States is behind him, that he is behind him, because it is an issue that was very sensitive. But I don't think it's something that came from an innate belief, if you will, political belief.
So you mean it wasn't in his character? He decided
that this
is...
It wasn't in his political... I don't think it is much in his political makeup to be behind, you know, a strong Israel. And not that he was against it, but it just wasn't something that he was terribly focused on. I think when you had Bush in there, it was something that he was automatically focused on.
It's interesting. Bush is also very religious, and he's tied to, you know, his religion because it helped him get through his alcoholism. And he may have a spot for Israel and think that that's really the place where a good Christian should have give his support. Obama, I guess he's Catholic and half, I mean, he's complicated. He says he's a good Catholic today, or Christian, I'm not sure.
I mean, I don't know if it's the religion as much as, you know, just the way, as far as the U.S. having a strong military and a strong defense, it's very important that Israel is secure and safe and exists, and we protect it when necessary.
Will George Bush go down in history as a great president 25 years from now because we had no 9/11 attack?
I think it's a little too early to
say. A lot of people say that,
by the way. It could be.
Ed Koch says that all the time.
But I think it depends how you get judged by, in bookends, if you will. We saw what happened, you know, under his predecessor, and we'll see what happens under Obama. I mean, if something, God forbid, does happen under the Obama administration, it will reflect positively on George Bush that he was able to do it. Everyone said he went too far and he's done too much when it came to security. But, it, you know, if you notice, even Obama's people have backed off a little bit,
very much.
You know, we have to really look at things. It's a different story once you get those national briefings.
Were you very upset on the night that Republicans lost the election, when McCain lost?
You know, it was very disappointing. But the most positive thing was all the good energy, if you will, that surrounded Barack Obama. And I think that it really did bring back a sense of nationalism that we haven't had in a long time. And that's good for the country. And that's good, even as you were discussing before. 70% of the economy is retail. People need, you know, people are really concerned now. Maybe if they have a sense of nationalism and hope, and that things can move forward, that'll move the economy as well.
One of the things you have to applaud Obama for is that he kept Bob Gates there. He's a great minister. He's the Secretary of Defense. We had him on the show years ago, and he's nearly apolitical. But
he took a lot of heat for that, because it showed, some people thought, especially to the extreme left, that it showed that he was giving up, that national security, a Democrat can't handle national security. And so he took a lot of heat from people for that.
Tell me, where is Rumsfeld? He's at the Minion.
An undisclosed location.
Where is he? I haven't heard a word about him. I don't know where he is.
That's probably a good thing.
Did he write a book? He didn't write a book.
No, not yet.
Really? I think he was a catastrophe for Bush and for the United States. I think he was a terrible defense secretary. I think Gates is really a top-notch guy and a really level-headed guy. And it's sad that many boys, I think, are killed because of Rumsfeld's policy. It really disheartens me. My question to you is that if McCain couldn't take it and Romney couldn't beat McCain and Huckabee couldn't beat anybody, do any of these people have a future? Romney, Huckabee? Huckabee seems to be a good talker, but what is it? You know, he has no place. He's a TV guy now.
It all depends where we are in a couple of years. I mean, a lot depends what happens in the next 18 months when we go into midterm elections. I mean, that
would be... Give me the young governors that are prominent now.
You have the governor out of Louisiana. You have...
he's very young. He's good. I forgot his name.
It's escaping
Bobby
right now. It's escaping me right now. But you have a lot. They're, it's not just looking. The party shouldn't necessarily say who's the next person. It should really start with what do we have to say for ourselves, and really start saying what do we represent, because it's more than image. We got to go deeper. We got to dig a little deeper.
I think the Republican Party has a chance now to really come together and build something if they do it correctly, especially with the younger and with the African Americans and with the Spanish people. If they incorporate those people into their party, I think they have a very good chance. And this guy Jeb Bush seems to be playing around. I think he thinks about coming, but this country does not like dynasties, not even the Clintons.
And certainly, Bush did not leave on very good note, so I don't think another one will be welcome so quickly.
Why didn't Bush, you don't know, let's speculate, why didn't Bush pardon Scooter Libby?
I thought it would be coming. I mean, I think everyone expected that one, but...
But they say that he never asked for a pardon, Scooter Libby.
Well, one could also say he didn't ask so he couldn't be told no.
No, you could say that. I was very surprised that he didn't...
Many people were.
He took a real hit. Dick Cheney, are you sorry to see him go?
I think it's more about not looking.
The whole place is laughing.
I think it's not about looking who's going, but what's in the future and what we have to look forward to. Because that's really where the party has to change as Republicans and as a country. That's where we've said as a nation, we've got to change things and we're going in this new direction.
One thing that the people of Israel will tell you is they like Cheney a lot, and they like, obviously, Bush a lot. But the question is whether you put that within the scope of the reality of the situation on the ground in Israel. And I don't think anybody knows the answer to that right now. It's very difficult to know. Susan, we're running short on your time and my time. Who's going to win the mayoralty in New York? That's going to be you got a Republican running, or is it Bloomberg on the Republican line? I'm not sure.
That's what it looks like it will most likely be. Yes, he'll be running as an independent and potentially and hopefully, honestly, as a Republican.
Really?
Yes, and he'll be given the Republican line.
So you may have a winner.
Yeah, I think he will. I think he is a winner already.
I like Mike Bloomberg. I think he's good at done a good job for the city. I mean, there are other people who may, come on and talk about him, and then we'll put him on. But I don't think anybody can contest the fact that he's an honest, honorable man. He doesn't need any political favors. He doesn't need any kickbacks or pushbacks or whatever the hell they do.
And he's shown that he can run the city.
And he likes it.
Susan,
thanks a
lot. Thank you.
For coming on. We're coming back with Mike Burstyn, who's going to talk about Meyer Lansky. And if you never heard of Meyer Lansky, he said last week, if you want to pick the best financial brain in probably the last century, probably was Meyer Lansky, except he was probably a hoodlum. But we'll talk to Mike about it. We'll be right back.
explore new worlds. Read. Visit literacy.gov and let the journey begin.
We're back. We're talking to Mike Burstyn. If you don't know who he is, you should turn off the television. He's been on Broadway, and I saw the opening of Barnum with him, and Broadway were the Rothschilds.
The Rothschilds.
Mike.
Ain't Broadway grand.
Right. He Joel Grey tries to emulate him all the time. They're the same style type of character. He's a great entertainer, well-known in Israel, won prizes, the best Israeli actor, Kuni Lemel, I believe. And, boy, I'm going back in my history here. Was a huge, huge star in Belgium, and now is on off-Broadway or Broadway, whatever you want to call it. Off-Broadway, I guess, is cheaper seating, maybe. But yes. Where are you? What theater, Mike?
We're at St. Luke's on 46th Street, just off 8th Avenue. And you're right, because the reason so many Broadway shows closed recently was because people, the economy again, what you were talking about, people can't afford to pay $120 for a Broadway ticket. They can pay $56 and see a good show. And save some money. So we're hoping that'll happen.
All right. Maya Lansky, in case people don't know it, was a Jewish... he was never convicted of a crime, but he was alleged to be one of the great mobsters during the 20th century.
He called himself a gambler, actually. He right. said, I was a gambler. And you're right. They tried several times to convict him. They could never prove anything because he was a brilliant... businessman, basically. He just happened to be in a
different
kind of business.
Did you ever meet him, by the way?
You know, I remembered yesterday somebody reminded me. In Israel, remember there was a little restaurant on Ben Yehuda called the Dan Cafe?
Yeah.
And they served kosher. It was a wonderful homemade kosher food.
Gefilte fish.
Yes, I remember. He used to come to that restaurant and sit
there.
With
Doc Stretcher.
Exactly, yes.
They lived at the old Sheraton Hotel.
The old Sheraton Hotel.
He had a poodle.
A Shih Tzu.
A Shih Tzu.
He had a Shih Tzu, yes.
Okay, it's probably in a play.
It is.
He had killer eyes, though. He had killer eyes. I remember looking in his eyes. He had killer eyes. It was amazing to me. I think Lee Strasberg played him in
The Godfather,
and
too.
And I represented Lee Strasberg. He also had tough eyes, by the way. I don't know if you remember him, but he had very tough eyes.
There's a true story that he and his wife were sleeping one morning after The Godfather came out, and there was a call that woke them up, and she picked up the phone, Anna, his wife, and it was a deep voice because Lansky had a deep voice, and he said, is Mr. Strasberg there? And she said, who's calling? And he said, it's Maya Lansky. And he got on the phone. He wanted to congratulate him for the way he portrayed him in the movie. True story. But before even that, I got to tell you something. You know, you're talking about Bush. I don't know whether people know this. This is a secret, but I can reveal secrets on your show. Before he left office, Bush made a special secret visit to Israel. He thought maybe at the last minute he can do something. And they say as he came off the plane at Ben Gurion Airport, he saw a man standing there in a long white gown with a long white beard holding two tablets in his arms, and two lights were shining out of his head. And Bush immediately recognized him. He walked up and he said, Moses, you've come to greet me. And the man walked away from him. So he ran after him and he said, Moses, it's me, George W. Any man walked away again. He finally said, Moses, why are you ignoring me? And Moses said, listen, the last time I spoke to a Bush, I spent 40 years in the desert. So that's a secret. Nobody should. Don't.
It's an exclusive for Page Six right now.
And exactly.
I'll come right after that.
By the way, you know, Leon, this play was originally done in Israel. That's
really?
That's how it came to me. It was done at the Comedy Theater.
Who did it?
Yossi Graber. A good Israeli actor.
Very good friend.
And it was directed by Yoel Zilberg. And Yoel sent me the play. It was originally written here by Richard Krevlin and Joseph Bologna, who was also directing it. I got the play, and I felt that at my stage, in this stage in my career, it was perfect. It's a one-man play. It was very difficult because I had to memorize 65 pages of text, you know. But
you got a Gemara head, which means a Talmudic mind.
Well, I inherited a little bit from your, you know... from your writings. But it's fascinating because I got to learn about a character that most people know from the legend of Meyer Lansky. You say Lansky, they all say, oh, yeah, he was a gangster. But he did so many things, you know, compared to Mr. Madoff now. You know, people have been asking me, what do you think? Is there a comparison? Are they both criminals, Jewish criminals?
I would say Lansky had more morals than Madoff.
Exactly. You know, Madoff, if it's true, deliberately and knowingly set out to harm his fellow Jews. With Lansky, it was just the opposite. He did everything he could in 1948.
Bring armaments to Israel.
Well, he and Luciano, and Lucky Luciano, they controlled the docks. Luciano controlled the docks in New York.
True.
And Arabs were, there was an embargo at the time on arms shipments to the Middle East. And they came to Meyer to help. And he went to Luciano, who at the time was in jail, and he said, we have to help. Luciano gave the word, and many of those arms shipments that were destined to Arab nations were redirected to Israel.
Right.
The rest of the arms shipments disappeared into the sea. And he did a lot of things. He also did a lot during World War II for the Navy. Naval intelligence came to them when they controlled the docks, and they were...
His son went to West Point.
His son was a graduate of West Point. He did many things that people don't know about, and the play brings out. It's a fascinating
study. Well, I think what's interesting about Lansky is Israel has a law of return, and every Jew could return. And Meyer Lansky was the only one that was turned back. And there were a lot of allegations that he didn't pay off the religious parties correctly because his friend Stature did pay off.
Stature did receive citizenship.
And he stayed there.
He stayed there. It's interesting. He was the
Stature
only Jew.
Stature came out of Las Vegas, by the way. He was one of those Las Vegas alleged mobsters.
Meyer was the only Jew. Look, there was a lot of politics involved as well. I mean, Nixon was president. He was sending phantom jets to Golda, and, you know, they wanted him back. It was an embarrassment that Meyer tried to use the law of return, which states that every Jew has the right to become an Israeli citizen and find sanctuary in the homeland.
By the way, I told that to Pollard, Jonathan Pollard. I told it to his parents. I don't want to get too heavy into the case, but I thought that if there would be a way of Pollard giving up his U.S. citizenship and just to go in Israel, he would be welcome there. But that's a long story, which one day I'll tell.
Well, look at who they allowed in the last few years.
Russians, oligarchs.
Oh, my God. Look who's controlling all the rackets today in Israel. Compared to Lansky, I mean, he was a bubala compared to these guys.
Right.
But at the time, you know, it was a different time in Israel. It was 1971. Golda heard from Yosef Burg, who was the Minister of the Interior. He came to Golda and he said, we have a problem. There's a Jew who wants to become a citizen.
This is facts, right?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And she said, what's his name? Lansky. She had never heard of him.
She probably said Lansky.
Yeah, and he said, well, what is it? What's the problem? He said, well, he was involved with the mafia. And Golda heard mafia, and she said, there will be no mafia in Israel. And so they rejected him. And he sued the Israeli government. He sued Burg and the Minister of the Interior. It went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And they proved there is an obscure clause in the law of return,
which says
a person can be denied citizenship if his presence in Israel can be seen as a threat to the public safety. That's what they used against him. And eventually he had to leave the country, came back to the States, died of natural causes. The federal government tried him three times, never proved anything. And his wife, after he died, a wonderful quote, she said, my Maya was the only one who died with his shoes off. True story. But I'm very excited about it.
You played it in Hollywood, right?
I played it in Los Angeles. We did a trial run there for 13 weeks. And now we brought it here off Broadway. And people were in previews now. We open February 5th, and the results have been, up till now, people are really fascinated by it, and I'm so happy to be back in New York.
It's a very entertaining show, and he was a fantastic character. And Mike is a great actor, and I'm sure it's spellbinding because the story is fascinating. And Lansky, I'm sure you bring it out. There's a paradox in these guys. You know, I at one time met Frank Costello.
We talk about Frank Costello. They were partners.
Okay, I didn't have
Francesco
anything to do with him.
Francesco Castiglia was his name.
Costello once came to me to represent him on a certain deal, and I didn't do it. It's not my deal. It's not the type of thing I do, and I met him through another client of mine. But they had certain values. Like, Costello wouldn't get into the trafficking of drugs. He was mainly in betting and other stuff. You know what I mean? They had their sense of values. And one of the strongest friends of Costello was Harry Truman. Harry Truman was brought up in Missouri by the boss over there, and he was very close. There's a whole thing about Harry Truman, how he got to be vice president and president.
You know, there's a lot of hypocrisy as well, because we talk about it in the show. They made their money, he and Luciano, during Prohibition, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, he says in the show, hey, don't blame me. There were a lot of other tough cookies competing with us, like Capone in Chicago, Bronfman in Canada, and Kennedy in Boston.
Right.
That's where they made their money during Prohibition,
right.
Bootlegging.
Right.
You know, it just so happens that they went on to be very respectable people. And Lansky, you know, another thing that's interesting, if you remember during the late 30s, well, you don't remember, but there were ongoing German-American Bund rallies. A well-known rabbi, whom I won't mention by name, and a New York Jewish judge came to Lansky, because legally the Jewish community couldn't stop them. They came to Lansky, they said, will you help? We'll pay for it if you can go out and stop these guys physically. He said, I don't want any money. I'm a Jew, and I care about what the Jews are going through in Europe. They went in to those meetings. They broke up those Nazi meetings. They broke Nazi arms, legs, and ribs, and they showed those Nazis that all Jews are not weak and scared. They broke up the Bund meeting. The only thing he asked of the rabbi was, and he's a very famous rabbi, and he said, the only thing we ask is, afterwards, don't blame us and call us criminals for what we did. Unfortunately, hypocrisy, the Jewish press went out and said, these guys shouldn't have done it. They're gangsters.
Really?
We can't do the same thing that they're doing. And when the Jewish press came out that way, the non-Jewish press came out as well. That was the only time that Lansky became a public figure. Before that, he was always in the background. He was the brains behind the mob. And they were not members of the mafia because they weren't Sicilian. They were Jewish.
Did he die feeling rejected by Israel? Was that very big in his
yes.
life?
Yes. His dream was to be buried next to his Zayda on the Mount of Olives. His,
really?
His grandfather and grandmother came to Palestine from Grodno, Poland in 1910. They're buried on the Mount of Olives. He was an old man already in the 70s. He was retired.
He played Pinochle at the Eden Rock.
Yeah, he used to walk his shih tzu along
Collins.
Yeah, that's right. So all he wanted was to die and be buried in Israel. You know, at the time, Israelis would have told you they were against letting him in. If you ask them today, most Israelis will say, hey, come on.
He could have been a pope today.
What was the big deal, you know? Anyway, it's a fascinating
Mike,
story.
Mike, you got to run to do your show.
Yep.
So where is it again? Tell everybody.
You want to know?
Yeah.
You sure?
I'm positive.
Okay.
Maybe I don't, but Obama wants to know.
Hey,
sure.
Listen, folks, this is an offer you can't refuse. St. Luke's Theater, 46th Street, just off 8th Avenue. It's Lansky, and you'll really enjoy it. You can get tickets on Telecharge. Just go to Telecharge. and Leon will later have a little spot there.
You sing them?
It's not a musical.
It's a drama.
It's not Lansky the musical.
All right.
I do a little Chazunish like we
Good
used
luck.
To do, remember?
Well, I'll play with it. Okay. When I see you over at Lansky, we'll bury him. We'll kill him. We'll rachem him. We'll give him a book of Kaddish, the mystery of Kaddish. Lansky knew when he died it was a mystery, and maybe Rabbi Blech will tell us how it's transmitted to him now by the Lord. That's why we've got rabbis to end the show. They give us blessings at the end. So we'll be right back. Lansky should be a fantastic night for you, and I would suggest that if you want to be entertained and stop being lugubrious about the financial world, it's probably a good place to go.
And finally, biology. to their challenge.
Me.
Take on the tough classes now. You need them to prepare for college.
We're in an emergency situation. We don't have extra. We have a little bit of water and a little bit of food. A meeting place, no.
No.
I don't think we have a first aid kit.
We have tuna fish. We have beans. We have canned tomatoes,
true.
You know.
That's true, but that's really not survival food. Tomato paste.
Yeah, well, yeah.
And what'd she say?
She said whatever.
No, she says that all the time.
What's that?
Hello? I'm on the phone. Mom, I'm on the phone! Hello? I'm on the phone.
Who's this? It's me. I'm on the phone. Mom?
Oh, you're on the phone. All right. Sorry!
Sorry.
Sorry.
Anyway.
Who are you talking to? Kelly?
Mom.
All right.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. There are thousands of teens in foster care who would love to put up with you.
Any questions?
No.
You know.
We're not magicians. We can't read your mind.
We need your questions, each and every kind. Will this react with my other medicine?
Hey, what are all these tests even for?
Big dreams and good grades aren't enough to get into college. There are actual steps you need to take. Finding someone who can help is the first and most important. For the next steps, go to knowhowtogo.org.
We're back. We're talking with Benjamin Black. He happens to be a rabbi and also an author, and he teaches at Yeshiva University, and he's well known for writing many, many books. But the last book he wrote was about the Vatican, and it was a fascinating book, and we had them on the show. He had a partner on that book, right?
Right.
I was a little bit disturbed by what happened this week when I saw that the Pope, in a sense, forgave one of his bishops. You know what I'm talking about.
Absolutely.
Tell me the inside behind that. What went on there?
More than a little bit disturbed. You know that the Israeli rabbinate, as a result of what happened, cut off relationships with the Vatican.
No, I didn't know that.
They were incensed, and they had every right to be. You know that a number of years ago, Lefebvre started a society for the Sacred Society of Pius X. And this was because he refused to accept the rulings of Vatican Council II, where they spoke about doing the prayers not in Latin, but more important about reconciliation with the Jews, etc. And this bothered Lefebvre very much. And there were a number of bishops that he subsequently consecrated, one of whom, Williamson, is a guy who denies the Holocaust, who publicly uttered tremendously anti-Semitic remarks. Now, these guys had been excommunicated because they went along with Lefebvre and didn't accept the rulings of the Pope. So last week, Pope Benedict rescinded the excommunication. And it turns out that a day before, he, this guy Williamson, had been in Sweden and given a speech denying the Holocaust, saying Jews weren't gassed. I mean, he's a fruitcake, a real fruitcake. And for the Pope to done this, I'll tell you why, but I have to say to you, and I have to be careful about how we express this, because you never want to say anything really derogatory about the Pope, but he simply doesn't get it. He has a tin ear for public relations. I guess the best way to put it is Pope Benedict is not Pope John Paul II.
It was there public pressure on him to do it? I mean, why would he? The Pope is the Pope.
I'll tell you why. He just didn't get the ramifications of this. He didn't understand how explosive this is. He, in his defense, says, look, a mistake of history is not heresy. The fact that this guy doesn't understand that the Holocaust happened is not the same as heresy. And what I'm trying to do is to break a schism from the church, bring these people back to the church. We don't like controversy. We don't like conflict. This is an opportunity to bring them back. Of course, then I'm going to ask them to accept Vatican II. I'm going to expect them to accept all the rulings that we have, and I'm going to expect this guy to admit that there was a Holocaust and to renounce the horrible things he said. But my God, not to understand the ramifications. Somebody high up in the Vatican, and I heard this, I can swear to this, very high up, doesn't want to be quoted by name, who couldn't really criticize the Pope, said, whatever was he thinking?
Really?
Whatever was he thinking? You know, Pope John Paul II was a man who was a diplomat. He had been an actor, I think you know that.
His predecessor,
His predecessor had been an actor, and he knew the world, and he was beloved all over. He never would have goofed like this. I think this is a perfect proof that the Pope is fallible.
I think you're being politically correct here, and I understand you, and you don't want to say that it's a foolish and silly and really nasty thing to do because it's offensive to Jews all over the world. So you're being politically correct, but I think it's maybe part. Look, this Pope came from Germany. His father has a lot to do with the Nazis or something like that.
That's what I would caution you about, though, and caution people about. I was with Pope Benedict after his predecessor died.
Right.
A short time thereafter, he went to Vladovice, which was the birthplace of the previous Pope, to pay his respects, and then went to Auschwitz. I was there with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to tell you, the media were ready to trounce him. They were looking for failings. He's not very popular. I remember before he spoke at Auschwitz, some guys got me from European TV, and they said, how do you feel about the fact that the Pope is going to be speaking in German in a place of Nazi victims? What a terrible, terrible thing. And I said, it doesn't matter what language he speaks in, as long as his points are proper and in place, etc. Turns out he didn't speak in German. He spoke in Italian. But they went out to get him. I have to tell you that his speech was absolutely beautiful.
I don't think he's anti-Semitic.
That's exactly the point that
people,
I want to make.
I think my point was that people right away associate that.
Right.
I'm going the other way.
We're too quick to jump.
I'm not doing that. Yeah. I say that people will say that.
Correct.
Because people are reactive, very reactive, and
correct.
Say Germany.
I don't know whether it's a compliment or not, but it's more ignorance than it is hatred
but
or anti-Semitism.
He had some bad advisors then. I mean, people should have alerted him. You know, the Pope is a huge, it's like the President of the United States, more, you know.
I guess people are afraid to say no to him. The problem is he's an intellectual, and as an intellectual, he's into books, he's into study, and he could dream that he could say to the world, well, look, here's the canonical difference. This man did not, he wasn't a heretic. He just has a wrong idea about history and couldn't understand what would happen in the outside world.
He's going to be harmed by this and the communities all over the world, not only by Jews, but, and you're right, maybe the cause is just the silliness or tin air, as you say, but he's going to be harmed.
You know, this is not the first time. You remember, very shortly after he became Pope, he made a speech about Muslims where he said things that were very critical. And you know what? You can feel that, but they're not things that you say in public. You have to be very, very careful.
He did something also about a Friday. I don't remember. There was something else that he did that the Jewish people objected to. I forgot what it was. I think Arthur Schneier was on here talking about it. But let me skip to a happy topic.
Yeah.
Bernie Madoff. Let me ask you, I made a speech about Madoff in Las Vegas when this thing happened. Now, Jewish people believe in redemption, tshuva, which means that you can repent. But it's very hard to get into an area where you want to allow a fellow like this who destroyed so many Jewish organizations, allegedly, because he hasn't been convicted. So I was reading a book about Spinoza, who was a pretty decent philosopher. I said, why don't we excommunicate him so you don't have to worry about the problem? I mean, in Jewish law, there is a concept of redemption, right?
Can I explain something? That Christianity and Judaism differ in this regard very strongly. In Christianity, all you got to do is confess, and all you have to do is, like all these people going on TV, I apologize. And the apology seems to take care of everything. In Judaism, repentance demands a great deal. Yes, we believe that there comes a time when you accept someone's repentance. He has to undo the harm that he did. He has to indicate that he will never do it again. He has to, if he's harmed people, go to every one of those people
and ask for
beg
forgiveness.
For forgiveness.
Right.
Do you know, when I was a little kid, my father took me with somebody who had insulted somebody and the man died. You have to go to the grave of that person and beg for forgiveness. Look at this Bernie Madoff. Look at his pictures. He's walking around smug and complaining that he's holed up in a Park Avenue penthouse, and he has something to complain about. He should be sitting in jail. And I don't even know if repentance is possible in his case, because you have to undo the crime. So I don't know where he's going to get $50 billion from to pay back these people. He hasn't even done the simplest thing, even from a Catholic perspective. He hasn't apologized to anybody. So there's no way to speak of redemption. There is no such thing as automatic forgiveness. It's not a free pass. Forgiveness has to be earned.
How bad did it hurt the Jewish community, Madoff, in your opinion?
I think we're just beginning to see the tip of the iceberg. More and more you see how many individuals were hurt, but the number of charities that were hurt and had to close down. And then what's going to happen when they can't continue next year? Maybe they're still running on budgetary funds that they had. It is beyond belief, because $50 billion is a big number.
Rabbi, always a pleasure. And these
My
are
pleasure.
Tough topics, but we hope you made a little happiness. Go see Lansky. He'll cheer you up a little bit, because the economy is down. You have people like Madoff plus a bad economy. That's not good. And if you're Jewish, you're offended by the silliness of a pope. This has been one hell of a week. So what I think you ought to do is put on some music and do a hula or something. In any case, we are duty-bound to give you what we see is going on. Maybe Obama can change things in the Middle East. We'll see. We'll see how George Mitchell does over there. And remember what I tell you. If there are rockets in Sderot, there'll never be peace. So keep your eye on Sderot. We'll see you next week.